Today's date is November 19th, 2018. My name is Jack White, and I will be interviewing today for the Housing Our Story Archival Justice for Black Baltimore Project. With me is Joseph Colon. Joseph, can you state your name and position under Hopkins?
My name is Joseph Colon. I'm the director for the Office of Multicultural Affairs on the Homewood campus.
Okay, Joseph. And where did you grow up?
I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, in pre-gentrified Fort Greene. I grew up in a pretty difficult neighborhood, in particular during the crack era of the 80s. And so it was pretty difficult to navigate as a young person. Dealing with not only drugs, but gangs and things of that nature was part of my life, but it was also a different set of time. I grew up in an awesome community, very multicultural. Mm-hmm. We had brownstones to my right and affordable housing to the left of me, and we were sort of in the middle of it all in mm-hmm. this equator-like mm-hmm. apartment-style building. Mm-hmm. So that's where I grew up.
That's really good. Was there any part of that experience that you find, affecting how you think about, people who maybe live in projects or people who live in brownstones by projects or anything like that?
Yeah. It definitely, going back to my neighborhood now, New York definitely has a different feel than it did, 20, 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. For me, it's nostalgic for me when I go back. I always look to the neighborhoods as is, just because I prefer that visual and that feel, even though it was a tumultuous time, very difficult time. Mm-hmm. It was during the Reaganomics.
Right.
And so that was a tough time to grow up, but it was also a joyous time because we had, I just remember the community at large was very supportive and looking out for each other's mm-hmm. kids or even each other. You could see us out on the stoop. But when I think about just the neighborhood at large, I think it's an interesting dynamic of how, I always reference the pre-gentrification period,
right?
Because there's something very special about that time that mm-hmm. really connected with me, whether it was playing tag or hide and seek in an apartment building that had multiple floors and rooftops to jump from rooftop to rooftop. Just to think about that,
yeah,
even to this day is kind of funny. But growing up in that environment, it was very freeing as a young person, particularly we call it concrete jungle. But it was one of those things that I wouldn't give up. I think one of the most dynamic things that happened to me, or actually most impactful things, is actually having that innocence, but then also that innocence lost almost.
Yeah.
Ideal of, just think about what our students currently or kids growing up now are dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
We always like to compare contrast generations.
Right.
And so there's always who had it worse or who had to walk the farthest to school,
yeah,
and things of that nature. But when I think about race in particular, I also have to connect it to socioeconomics. When I grew up in that area, it was, again, we had folks who could afford brownstones that weren't ridiculously priced like they are now.
Right.
But those were middle class folks who actually did really well. Spike Lee lived up to 2-3 blocks away from me.
Wow.
Across the street from the park. Mm-hmm. He was a normal person in our neighborhood that we, mm-hmm. we could actually touch and talk to. He invested in the neighborhood. There was a lot of Black pride. There was a lot of people of color pride. There was a specialized high school up the street from us called Brooklyn Tech, which I always fought to not go because it was too close to home.
Yeah.
I was just an adventurous kid. When I looked at it, I definitely saw New York as a interesting hodgepodge of folks and just connection to each other. But I could also see that there were a lot of differences, particularly within the communities. Even though we were very familiar with each other, there was still a disparity again, regarding folks of color, right, in particular, Black and Latino folks. And even the folks who decided to not have white flight that decided to stick around. It was just a different time, a different place. Economically, we were all, we were struggling to some degree. Now, not so much. People aren't struggling who held on to those brownstones. Mm. But yeah, when I think about particularly where I grew up and race, I always connected with socioeconomics. You know, it's just interesting. My mom was a single parent mom. She brought me up. She had me when she was 15.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being on welfare, standing in line to the church next door to us, getting government cheese, mm-hmm. and not knowing that that was not, that felt like it was a norm for me.
Mm-hmm.
My mom didn't stay on public assistance for too long. But it was impactful to even to this day, yeah, to think about it, yeah, as something that I grew up not knowing what poverty looked like,
right,
because it was a norm. But right, my mom, she really struggled, and she also persevered so that we wouldn't have to do that for too long. So when I think about my childhood, when I think about that neighborhood and what it used to be and what it is still, it's all those things in particular.
That's really powerful, yeah. And then what brought you to Baltimore then? And like, why Baltimore? And was it the job that brought you? Or did you come here and then find a job? Was it Hopkins?
Yeah, so I actually, I was working at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And I decided, you know, 2 years in, I was like, let me see what else is available. And I happened upon a position here within residential life. And so I just decided to see what, you know, throw my hat,
right,
in the ring. And so, ended up getting the position, and I've been here ever since. As many New Yorkers like to do, they like to compare, contrast.
Right.
I was so upset that they didn't have the same amenities, like the subways,
right,
and just,
right,
the communities, you know, as far as being really, I think in New York, we do have those pockets of communities,
right,
but there's so many people there that it's, right, almost a fusion. And so what really was interesting about Baltimore was that it had a different feel.
Right.
It was beautiful in many ways. It was gritty, and it was very familiar to me.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, it also had this this very city-like feel. I know, coming off, the first time I came to Baltimore, coming on the off of the highway, off of 95,
right,
when you pass Ravens Stadium,
right,
I just thought to myself, wow, this is a beautiful city.
Yeah.
And then it filters out and opens up into kind of probably one of the most, one of the poorest areas in kind of, so you kind of just, you get to see the juxtaposition around, right, that. But the reason why I'm here in Baltimore is because of a job opening, and I ended up calling it home for,
yeah,
18 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And then where do you live now in the city, or just generally, or however specific you want to be?
Yeah, so I currently don't necessarily live in the city. I live on the outskirts of, okay, the city. So,
okay.
I'm in Mount Washington right now.
Oh, okay.
Before that, I lived here in the Homewood area,
mm-hmm,
Homewood campus area. So, and then I kind of moved around pretty much in the county. I've lived in the county. I've lived in the city. So that's where I typically live.
Is there a reason why you moved out there, or is it just, this is where you found something, or?
I think I moved out there because, one, taxes,
right,
are a lot cheaper,
yeah,
exponentially cheaper, which is sad to say, but it's one of those things. Rent was a lot cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
The communities were, I was looking for a diverse community. Mm-hmm. So I was looking for a place that actually, I could actually, get all those things all in one.
Right.
I'm a big proponent of community. So,
right,
you know, for me, it's important. One of the big tellers for me is, going to a grocery store and seeing, mm-hmm, where the grocery stores are,
right,
and kind of seeing who frequents it. And so, I lived in a pretty diverse area, right off of Reisterstown Road, which is the borderline of the county and the city.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's why I moved out there.
Right.
Plus my wife was out there as well. So
right.
we ended up moving out there.
Okay. And so then now you're at the Office of Multicultural Affairs and you said you started at Res Life. Were there any, what were the jobs that you had and how did that progress, I guess?
Yeah. Time? So my position in Multicultural Affairs was the assistant director for residential life. So I was basically in charge of a whole area of cluster residence halls. And then I was actually looking for another position, and I got a position in New York, which would have been phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
But we had some negotiation issues, particularly my living situation.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually was going to be a director for residential life for
right.
a school out there. That didn't pan out, so I decided to stick around just a little bit longer. And so this position in multicultural affairs for an assistant director popped up open. And there was a need particularly for us to diversify the staff in particular. So I applied for the position, stayed in it. I've been there since 2008, 2007. And I've kind of moved up within the I guess the department, the office. Went from assistant to associate and finally director. So that's kind of been my trajectory here
right.
at Hopkins.
Right. This is just a little tangent that I want to take. You've talked a lot about multiculturalism and how that's an important part to you and you're working in the office for it. Do you have any origins of how that came to be an important thing for you, or can you describe how it's important to you, or the value that it has to you as an effector on one's life?
Mm-hmm. So I have to go back a little wee back. So growing up in Brooklyn, particularly during that time, I noticed that there was a lot of assaults and things of that nature within my community, particularly inter-race and inter-group. While I was in middle school, I ended up getting jumped about 7 times within
wow.
a span of probably 2 months. I had navigated some areas. I kind of knew some folks that I could lean into that could help me alleviate my situations.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was kind of interesting to actually talk to folks, particularly in my community, be like, I need help because I'm getting jumped. And even wasn't getting any help with the police. I
right.
was getting help with my teachers.
Right.
I went to a specialized a junior high school for students who did really well in school.
Mm-hmm.
But we were smack in the middle of the projects.
Right.
And so they had to let us out 10 minutes before because it was such a difficult area.
Mm-hmm.
In particular with other schools, neighboring schools coming to either harass us or jump us or however
mm-hmm.
inflict any type of assaults. So people were getting bus passes stolen or even money, shoes. ABC, which is A Better Chance, is a nonprofit group that basically comes into schools, public schools in particular, for high achieving students. And I actually got a scholarship to go to a boarding school in North Andover, Massachusetts.
Oh.
Which was a whole different...
Mm-hmm. You go to Andover or...
I went to Brooks School, which
oh.
is the sister school to Andover.
Oh, okay.
So so I didn't know what I was getting myself into.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't an only child. So my mom had a younger sibling, but I'd always been that one kid who just... I mean, I did everything and anything. So
mm-hmm.
my mom... asked me and she said, do you want to do this? And I said, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Because my neighborhood had gotten a little rough.
Right.
Fast forward, I ended up going to boarding school, having a great time, really fit in. But as many folks who walk into some of those predominantly white institutions,
right.
we tend to assimilate almost to a fault, to mm-hmm. a point. And as a mm-hmm. youngster, I never really got, I understood the dynamics of race and class and so on and so forth. I was a kid who only had 3 blazers for 6 days of class, of school, days of school. And I never noticed it, but I was hiding that by kind of trying to be a fashion mogul by switching out different clothing styles or mm-hmm. even pants just to make it look somewhat as if I had some means to really represent in this boarding school environment. I couldn't even afford the patch to put on my blazer, so mm-hmm. that didn't happen until I graduated, which was embarrassing at the time, but it's whatever. I really grew into this space until the first time someone used an ethnic slur towards me. And we had an issue on the campus with a Confederate mm-hmm. flag being basically outside the window, and mm-hmm. so people could see, and that really affected me mm-hmm. big time. Mm-hmm. And so I did something courageous during that time, which transforms my experience mm-hmm. for the past that, which is I basically got in front of the student body and told them my story, what had happened, and how I felt as if I belonged nowhere.
Right.
And this was the one place that I felt like I could actually be free and be safe. Whereas back home, I didn't feel safe. But now I felt unsafe in the mm-hmm. two places that I call home.
Right.
And I just remember the audience kind of like hushed and mm-hmm. Even telling my story, it was really difficult at the time to make some proclamations that I would not tolerate X, Y, and Z.
Right.
And it was a life-changing experience for me.
Definitely.
People, they treated me differently afterwards, even some of my friends, because mm-hmm. They didn't know how to approach me or how to connect with me.
Right.
And some folks just didn't bother to engage with me. But the thing that it taught me was that I had to create and cut out my own space.
Mm-hmm.
Being Puerto Rican is important to me, but I also had to dive deep into the cultural aspects of what makes a Puerto Rican, a person of color in particular,
mm-hmm.
With my lineage. And so I did some of that stuff. And I got into the Afro-Caribbean. I got into my, as what they call now, the colonizer roots, in a sense. But those were important things to me to kind of, really engage with my ethnicity and my culture. And in particular, finding my place and no longer living in limbo,
mm-hmm.
Culturally and also mm-hmm. Race and ethnic wise. Those were some things that really transformed my experience. And then in college, I just took some courses that furthered my education. I went to Temple University in Philadelphia, which was 18,000 students. I went from 500 high school students to 18,000. And now I'm like, oh, what's going on here? And even though I was a city kid, it was Philly. It was different.
Yeah.
And so I had to get used to that as well. And so I started to really do a lot of social engagement in politics within Philadelphia and really, getting involved
mm-hmm.
In the community. And it somehow led me into student affairs. And as many student affairs professionals will tell you, that like you kind of just fall into it.
Oh.
Like, oh, this is something awesome that I'm good at. And mm-hmm. I'm like, great. I'll try it for a year or two, and then mm-hmm. you end up, it becomes a career. So, but yeah, there's been a lot of key points in my life that kind of transformed my direction as the multicultural affairs. I've kind of veered more into the equity piece.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I think the conversation is less of we always talk about race and ethnicity. But I think people are afraid to talk about race and ethnicity.
Right.
It's that difficult subject. So, but you can always enter that conversation through the point of equity.
Right.
And I think that for some people, that's much more of a entry point.
Yeah.
A pretty great entry point for folks to kind of really get into the right. deep issues.
Right. I guess I do want to touch on what it's like to work specifically for Hopkins. And so, two questions together are like, what are the responsibilities of your job? And what's like the average day like for you mm-hmm. working at Hopkins?
Okay. Wow. Okay. That's a lot. So our office, we have about, we have five total folks who actually work within the office. I manage pretty much the day-to-day operations of our office. We do everything. We have a three-prong approach about how we engage all types of conversations, particularly about diversity and inclusion. We're under the umbrella of diversity and inclusion, which includes us, OMA, for short, Women and Gender Resources. We have LGBTQ Life and then Campus Ministries. So we kind of work in tandem. And so our office historically actually did all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And so we noticed that we were doing, it was way too much work, right, for just one office. So I'm glad to have my brothers and sisters in the in those offices. But we actually put on programming, pretty intense programming. We've graduated from cultural months to celebrating full year. So we call it 365, Heritage 365,
mm-hmm.
Which is a different take on cultural celebrations. And so Black Heritage Month, Black Heritage Celebration, Latinx Heritage Celebration, mm-hmm. so on mm-hmm. and so forth. And we also have the Asian Pacific Heritage and also Indigenous. So it's a great first year run. We've been very busy. We also do diversity education, so that we work with SEED, Students Educating a Power for Diversity. It's a student group and initiative. Train students, they do trainings. They also do professional presentations. They also do programming. They really engage the community in difficult conversations. They go beyond the surface level stuff. And so those are some areas. And then we also do leadership development with our student groups and organizations. We have almost 40 student groups and organizations that we support, and mm-hmm. and we strive to support. And so that's kind of the crux of it all. Me personally, I am currently, if I'm not in a meeting, which is a meeting culture here at Hopkins,
mm-hmm.
I'm typically out supporting our students as an advisor, or I'm specifically working with advocacy stuff,
mm-hmm.
Or I'm sitting in boards and chairs. I actually chair a regional nonprofit of schools and organizations. So that's been kind of on my radar for years as a add-on to my job,
mm-hmm.
The Washington Regional Task Force. So we have a conglomerate group of colleges and universities. And so, yeah, just creating new ways in which we actually engage our students through race, right. race, gender,
right.
Ethnicity. We really do try to strive to make sure that we're supporting our student groups and organizations, whether they're protesting, providing demands, or even getting students into the conversation. I've noticed that we've gotten a pretty diverse group of students interested in diversity work,
mm-hmm.
Inclusion work. And so that, to me, says a lot about the generation that's coming in.
Right.
I'm really excited about right. that. So my work has been more about informational. We're looking to work with other offices as well. And so we're really engaging in some of those relationship buildings, building more relationships with Center for Africana Studies, East Asian Studies, and also the program in Latin American Studies as well, because they connect and they dovetail with our student groups and organizations.
Mm-hmm.
So we do a lot. I probably haven't covered everything, but a day in my world is typically just making sure that we manage 35 plus groups well through the Multicultural Leadership Council, which is a whole nother group, SEED. There's also a mentoring program involved. So that has over 180 folks participating in it. So it's a lot. It's a pretty big endeavor. And then we're adding more stuff onto our plate. So we're launching a podcast to talk about a counter narrative about some of the things that are being put out there,
mm-hmm.
giving people platform. We have, we've been really looking at other teaching tools and areas in which we can actually do online and dovetail it with, like, you know, actual in-class curriculum work. So we'll be venturing into that arena as well. We're just interested in just really developing our students holistically, but also
mm-hmm.
to be proud of who they are,
right?
Right. Wherever they come from.
Mm-hmm. So. What is it like working for Hopkins? Do you feel, I want to say, appreciated? Like, do you feel like the administration values the work that the office is doing, or do you think that they kind of just did it because they felt like they had to? Like, do you, I guess, how do you feel about the relationship between like your work, OMA, and Hopkins as an entire institution, I guess.
Yeah. So I think we're at an interesting transition period that's transitioning from the preliminary kind of fact-finding stuff. I also know that our office has been doing that work for over 25 years. Mm-hmm. So we have a different take on what diversity and inclusion has been like on this campus. Mm-hmm. I think with the rise of student protests over the past 3 years over social issues, particularly Freddie Gray has really, for it to be so close to home has really given a different perspective about what we should be doing as an institution. I think one of the things that probably plagues us is our decentralization as an institution. Mm-hmm. So there are pockets of folks doing several things around diversity and inclusion with no real pull to kind of pool the resources and connect the dots. And so, you know, I think that when we talk about doing the work, I think we have to, I think we're in a transition where we're veering ourselves from the building blocks and actual written documentation. So the roadmap for diversity and inclusion, what does that look like?
Mm-hmm.
How do we make sure that we're holding ourselves accountable to a lot of those things that are put in there, mm-hmm. but that we're also evaluating that document? And what are we doing internally as a university at large? Like, is everyone doing the work? You know, I think it's so easy to just pawn off that work to a certain area because that's what their function is.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never worked that way, particularly when it comes to students, because if a student comes to me, then they need my help.
Right.
I need to be the not just a conduit or liaison or a referral,
mm-hmm.
but I have to know what's happening. I have to know the inner workings. I'm not sure if campus-wide, if we're there yet.
Right.
And I think people want to learn more. I think professionally, it is frustrating at times because there are so many entities that need, they need to go beyond just the policy. They kind of have to go a little bit deeper than we've been able to. But I also know that folks are on a different strata when it comes to diversity and inclusion.
Mm-hmm.
I really would love, if I had to envision a Hopkins where we were kind of more centralized in this arena, it would go beyond just documents and actually having each area have a plan of action.
Right.
A full engagement plan in which we all are at the table. People are not, their egos are checked at the door. And that there's no issue with asking for assistance if you don't know where to start.
Right.
But at the same time, that there's an accountability piece and that we're all supporting each other as individuals.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I've had frustrations over the years, as you can imagine, being a part of, you know, social justice, you know, just being entrenched in a lot of this work. And also going outside into the city, you know, I put a lot of value, I put on a lot of value in that work. In particular, going out into like the Latinx community and going out into the LGBTQ community and being an ally for everyone and anyone in the mm-hmm. city, noticing that there's been an influx of community organizations happening, propping up or folks who have been supported for years that have been here. So I think the disconnect, I think we do several projects that have a Hopkins name. I think we need to look at it from a perspective of like what's already here and mm-hmm. how do we support those pieces,
mm-hmm.
And not just legitimizing a nonprofit, but actually being partners
mm-hmm.
instead of being a good practitioner stems from humbling yourself and kind of being in the midst without actually feeling like you're a savior.
Right.
You're an influencer. You're a connector.
Right.
A liaison.
Oops, sorry.
Yeah.
So you talked about, like, the protests, and so specifically, like, with regards to the police force that Hopkins has been talking about getting, is there any, like, do you, when you look at that sort of proposal and you look at the response to them, you even have a newspaper on your desk right now about it. Do you feel like, does that interplay with your role in the office at all? Like, do you feel like it's in terms of, you know, like the functions of the office, do you feel like, or even with your role or just in the goals of multiculturalism, do you feel like having a police force or the way that the university is going about the police force, do you think that that, like, I guess, what are your thoughts on that in regards to those?
I think, so I went to a university, type of university, who had a police force. It was, I think, the second largest police force in, like, the state or, maybe I might be misquoting, but mm-hmm. I know it was one of the largest, if not second to Philadelphia police. We had some issues in that area, particularly they had to adapt because we were in the city, specifically right. North Philly,
right.
which was infested with a lot of crime and a lot of poverty, to have to navigate some of those, culturally sensitive pieces to the puzzle, as a police force and also supporting students on campus. That's tricky. It's mm-hmm. very tricky. And, you know, my experiences have been, you know, when you talk about safety versus policing, those are things that I think on the table we have to kind of contend with. We have to talk about how we approach some of those methods. Are we actually including the neighborhoods right. in the conversation?
Right.
What would that do? What is the buy-in strategy? How do we get true statistics on to be able to explain the necessity for it.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, when I think about my students, kind of, I know our students have been opposed to it as well. I support them as an advocate of the office. In particular, we want them to have a voice and to be able to really engage in that social justice conversation. I think it's an important piece to the puzzle that I wish as I wish I was a little bit more involved in when I was a young person, a young college student, throughout my time. But I think the policing part is a difficult conversation. I see the pros and cons to it. But I also know that it takes a long time to kind of build up the rapport that you need, particularly within the community to build a rapport within the community and also maintain safety on campus. It's just a tricky position. I think it's doable. I also think language is important. Mm-hmm. So when people hear police force, they think of the Baltimore Police Force. They think about the corruption.
Right.
Who are we bringing in?
Right.
What do we currently have? What's the system? Does privatizing, you know, quell any issues or fears?
Mm-hmm.
There's a training certification quelling those. I have no idea what that looks like, but I support my students, and I think that, you know, with all those things put forth, they've done a lot of homework, we've done our homework. I think we just need to get together and figure out what does this look like.
Right.
We also don't know if this legislation is going to go through
right.
or if it's going to be uplifted, but I definitely think that it's one of those things that it's just a difficult topic. Someone who came from an institution with a strong police force,
mm-hmm.
But then looking at other institutions, we're not a large school. So for us, it's going to be a lot of bridge building.
Right.
It has to take time. And I don't want us to also live in a fear-based or fear-mongering
mm-hmm.
environment either. Right. So, and things could happen on this campus and things could not happen on this campus. I think we have to really concentrate on multiple factors of what makes our students safe, particularly mental health. And we're talking about that piece. And we also want to talk about racial disparities, trauma, things
right.
like that. And those are things that I think have to connect with the safety of our campus.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm I'm 100% behind our students and the fact that we want to support them as an entity. We also want to make sure that our students are safe, however that plays out, whether it's not whether it's a police, an official police force, or and figuring that those political landmines, and then making sure that we are communicating with the community is, I think, utmost. I'm not sure if I'm not particularly sure about the timing of the last push to kind of put this through the legislation, but what I do know is that we're in the process of kind of laying the foundation of having conversations around that. What does that look like? I have no idea, because I think the forums after a certain point will provide us some context, but and then going into the communities will provide us some resolution and some context. But I think there's always going to be, particularly from our students, we're not an activist campus. Our students are not heavily into activism, but I've been very motivated and really touched by the students who are looking at multiple angles of social justice within our systems and how broken our systems are and how we need to really contend with that and really ask some tough questions about who we are as an institution.
Yeah.
So I think this is one of them that hopefully we can kind of find a compromise in between.
That's all I have. I really appreciate your time, and I appreciate you being candid and just responding to the interview question.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Yeah, made me think a lot about my own experiences and as a student and then living in the city as well. So I appreciate that. That was really cool.
Okay, thank you.